In today's film, we experience a poignant family drama and coming-of-age story from multiple points of view. Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week, I plan to bring you in-depth insights into the creative process of storytelling. And folks, I got to say, without a doubt, I was quite pleased to have with us today writer-director Sir Kenneth Branagh to talk about his latest film, Belfast. And you know, a story like this that's so personal to the artist, it's not always so easy to tell. It doesn't always get the audience on your side because the hat trick here is being able to take your own personal story and deliver it to audiences in a fashion that feels familiar to them as well. And without a doubt, Mr. Branagh succeeded. It's connected with audiences and critics alike. So he was very forthcoming about his creative process and what it took to make Belfast. So I know you'll dig this episode. And speaking of things to dig, I hope you check out Backstory over at backstory.net. You could read us on a desktop or laptop or via our iPad app. Backstory. Of course, we also recently published our winter issue, our Dune issue, and you could see what's inside of it over at our table of contents. And there's so many great articles and scripts to read in there. So I know there's a lot for you to enjoy. If you've never read Backstory before, I hope you consider test driving us and reading our free issue. And if you like what you see, I hope you consider becoming a subscriber. And if you want to subscribe, I'm here to make you a deal. I hope you use coupon code SAVE5. That's save and the number 5. You could use it at backstory.net and that will save you $5 off a 1-year subscription. Look, it would really mean a lot to me to have my podcast listeners in iTunes and Spotify and my YouTube watchers of the Backstory Magazine YouTube page, which is where all these Zoom interviews go. So if you want to see Kenneth Branagh explaining right to camera these heartfelt feelings about his film, make sure to go check out our YouTube page. But really, it would mean a lot to me to have all of you consider supporting my passion project and becoming subscribers. So thanks for considering. But now, without any further ado, let's jump right into our conversation with writer-director Sir Kenneth Branagh about his latest film, Belfast.
How are you doing?
Good. I love your film, and I was lucky enough to see it when y'all were basically doing that rooftop little get together. So it was a lot of fun here in Los Angeles. And you know, I just want to go back for a second because writing during the pandemic has been difficult for a lot of writers, and it's really impressive how motivated you were to get this done. So I'm curious, was there another project you were working on before Belfast, or at what point did Belfast materialize for you?
Well, it's been, as they say, burning a hole in my head for about 50 years kind of burning a hole in my heart as well. So it's always been on a kind of side burner, you know, and it's always been a stepped process. For me, I wanted to write about it and then see what happened. So I didn't write thinking, I'm going to make a film of this. I don't think anybody could, you know, during the pandemic or at any time, basically. But with this one, that without a specific reason, I knew that I wanted to show the screenplay to my brother and my sister and say, look, this is partly based on our family. What do you feel about this? If they'd said they didn't like it or want it to be made, I wouldn't have done it. So, but I knew that writing it up to that point would still be immensely valuable to me. So it always had that thing of it, the thing itself being what was the motivation, you know. So end results weren't there, or even the certainty that you could do things. So once they said that they enjoyed it and approved of it, then came the thing of, well, how can we make it? And you know, to answer your question further, we were nearly finished in post-production for Death on the Nile. We were waiting for some visual effect shots to kind of cook, as it were, the last ones of those. And so I was essentially, like many people, becalmed. But Belfast had always been on the bubble. So not with any specific intention to make it, but certainly to write it, I launched in because 50 years of consideration about it was driving that sort of avalanche of material.
Of course, something autobiographical like that would necessitate notes from your siblings. I hadn't even thought of that. That sounds like the possibility for really terrifying notes. What were their notes like? Was there anything that you had to make a big change for that you just couldn't have seen going in, or were they just so into it that there was no worries?
It was a scary moment to hand it over because I hadn't told them I was doing it. I wanted the writing of it to be as sort of as free and direct to my creative instinct as it could be. But as it turned out, my brother particularly had a very emotional reaction to it. And he, what he did say was, he said, "You put stories in there that happened to me, not you." And I said, "Really?" I said, and we talked about some of this stuff, and we realized, and this was the first understanding of really creating a style in the movie, because it reminded us memory is a very fluid thing, that we both had different memories of who did what. And, you know, and so he claimed to have done things. I said, "But that's exactly what I did. You were never even there." And we had a laugh about that. And that began to allow us to understand that there is a memory or dream quality to it that just has to be the case, because people can't remember in encyclopedic detail. The psychiatrists say, you know, the facts of one's life are less important than how we remember them. So this is about how we remember them. And then my sister just said, "Well," she said to me, "this is amazing. You're the most private and quiet and contained man I know, and you've just outed yourself." So for her, it was the, whatever you'd call it, confessional or intimate nature of the reveal of inner life or whatever. That was a surprise. But both were very enthusiastic and moved. But again, they didn't even really know, understand, or neither did I. Well, could we make it? Would COVID allow us to make it? But were they with it? Yes, they were, with a sort of, kind of a talking over each other kind of delight in trying to remember some of the details.
You know, I've interviewed you before about your writing habits, and obviously for something autobiographical, I'm curious if it is still necessary to outline, or do you do it just more as a flow of consciousness when you're sitting down and writing about your own life versus writing, you know, a more traditional screenplay?
Well, that's a very interesting question, I think, and I think there are legitimately many different sort of answers. What I did was to really, quite specifically, I wrote down on lots of index cards individual incidents, as many things as I could remember about this time around, basically around the period of violence when the troubles from our point of view started, all the way through to the point when we left. And I would say very little on each card. It might be a character, it might be an incident, it might be a line of dialogue, it might be a memorable moment. Sometimes it was how somebody looked or whatever. And I gathered them. I think there were like hundreds of them. And then I rearranged them. I decided to look through and see, did anything form itself into a first act? Was there anything that pulled itself out and said, that's the end of the first act, or that's the end of the second act? And things began to emerge. So clearly the riot was critically important at the beginning. The looting of the supermarket was critically important. The wake was critically important. How do we get to those? And then, so I pinned an axe worth up on the board, and I looked around, moved it around a lot. And then when I wrote it, I again improvised and changed things around. So I did have, I kind of tried to catch the memories. Then I tried to organize them, and then they sort of organized me.
That's interesting. How long was your outlining process for before you started writing?
I guess it was about a month, I suppose, because I knew this thing. It was like it was, you know, building. And I guess maybe my wife was very, very much onto the notion of quite how severe this pandemic would be. I was one of those people who thought, well, you know, it's not, we will be able to contain this in some way. Or I didn't understand it well enough to take it as seriously as I might otherwise have done. But she did. And I think it made me aware that I should probably get on with this. So I found it in almost every waking moment, wherever I was for about a month ahead of this, that I would have these cards with me all the time, and I would just write down anything, anywhere. And so, yeah, it was about a month of doing that. And then I started writing and then reorganizing at the same time. So I kept a couple of processes going. I didn't want to be too formal. I didn't want to be too casual. I didn't want to be too stream of consciousness. I felt there had to be a plot. And there was a structure, and they emerged. And I was quite disciplined about how I did it. You know, every morning, 9 o'clock, boom, had to write by then. Had to literally be typing. Otherwise, well, I didn't ever not do that, even though sometimes, you know, I rewrote significantly, but I needed the discipline.
Well, that's good to hear about your daily habit. When you sit down to write, do you give yourself a certain amount of hours to write, or do you try and hit a certain amount of pages?
I don't worry about the pages. No, I try and keep going. And so it tended to be about 4 hours. And of course, it wasn't constant. You'd get up, sure, you'd walk about, you have to think about it for a lot. As long as I was writing by 9 o'clock, as long as something had gone through, maybe the first page comes out in that first spurt. Sometimes, as you know, you get a bit luckier than that. Sometimes you're enjoying something. Sometimes you can push through, and sometimes it's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of staring. It's a lot of throwing the paper away. But one thing I've learned, and I've learned from the best writers, is just keep going. Just keep going. I always think of, you know, if you compare, I don't know, with something like sculpture. I mean, with the process of writing, you've got to create the block first, haven't you? You have to,
right,
literally, you have to make the block of stone before you can start chipping away from it and finding what's in there. And that can sometimes be, at least in my limited view and limited experience, a laborious but necessary process.
How long until your first draft?
I don't know, about 6-7 weeks, I guess.
Okay.
But I was at it, I would say, certainly 6 days a week. It came out with some rapidity, I would say, yeah.
You know, just as this is such a personal project, it was really nice to see a Thor comic book in there, and you directed Thor and did a fantastic job of that. And I remember at the time interviewing screenwriter Don Payne about how much he enjoyed the experience of working on Thor. And it was nice. And I'm just curious, just before we really dig into kind of the spoilers more, a little more on Belfast, what was your favorite memory from Thor? What was just a great personal moment for you as a director that's really stuck with you over the years?
Well, it was actually with Don Payne, as you know, sadly departed, amazing, beautiful man, very funny, great writer on The Simpsons, of course, for many years. And he was with us all the way through. We had many excellent writers, but Don was there for a large, large part of it. I guess he and I, walking down the main street in the town that we, in New Mexico, that we built, it was actually the town on the Tom Ford Ranch, which originally had been used as in Silverado. And we turned it into a modern street and created this, I thought, very cool, isolated desert place. Seeing the magic of that thing, you know, be there and being able to go into any one of the stores. There was a pet shop, there was a cafe. I remember we had our lunch in the diner in that street. It was from catering, but there was a diner and we could have, it was a diner in which eventually Thor would be munching away on, right, on stuff like a ravenous horse as Natalie Portman watches him, or he, where he orders a horse from the pet shop next door. It was, and that was when you thought it was amazing to have the resources of Marvel to create that thing, because I knew that we could blow it up, that we could have Thor down there, that we could march the destroyer up that street, that we could construct a fire, we could have the space that we wanted, we could let our imaginations rip. So, you know, that's when you think the glory of doing a great big movie like that is being able to realize those dreams. And for me, those dreams were from the comic books, and those comic book images of what we built and Don and I sat and had our diner lunch at came out of comics that I was reading back in Belfast.
That's awesome. Well, so we're going to get into the spoilers. So podcast listeners, if you have not yet seen Belfast, please go see it and press pause for a minute until you do. And we're going to get into the spoilers. You've been warned. You know, one of the easiest places to start that I was a little surprised by, but it was interesting, is that your point of view shifts. And I could have seen it easily to just be Buddy's story, but we get scenes where he's asleep and the parents are arguing and we really get into their lives. I'm curious what inspired the point of view shift and some of the movies that maybe also inspired you for this, for Belfast.
Well, some of the movies that inspired the picture are movies like Au Revoir les Enfants, the Louis Malle film about childhood, which is so heartbreaking, so beautifully acted. And actually a recent film by Pavel Pavlikovsky, Ida, which was Best Foreign Language Oscar winner in 2016.
Right.
It's the most beautifully composed and shot movie. Both of them have an influence in as much as there's tremendous tenderness in Au Revoir les Enfants, beautiful, sweet quality that comes from a sort of real appreciation of what childhood means. When we shift the point of view in Belfast, it's still to try and retain that. So, for instance, in what you mentioned, the parents arguing, but in that very scene, we have the sleeping Buddy in the foreground. It's a four shot, which doesn't shift. It's a locked off camera. And this very important conversation about whether the parents will still stay married or whether the children deserve a life exposed to danger, which the current troubles in Belfast impose upon them, is constantly, I would say, affected by seeing the soft out of focus vision of the chocolate mouthed, Christmas tired buddy at the front of the frame, occupying the sort of right hand third of it. When the POV shifts, somehow we still keep him there, almost as if, not to be too pretentious about it, that he's almost dreaming this story as well when he's not actually.
Oh, that's honest. Interesting.
And that capacity in the mind of a 9-year-old who loves movies, I think, is part of seeing how this imagination is developing and trying to tackle with what little he has, his 9 years of experience of the world, such as that is, the advice or education of his school parents, grandparents. But then he's got his passions, the girl, soccer, movies. And these are dreamlike things to try and somehow bring order to this tangible, real, violent street, you know, sort of revolution.
Right.
Trying to find a way to keep him present, but allow his imagination to dictate quite a fluid and quite a varied tone. But the kind of framing that you'll see in Ida is one that inspired us to sometimes just hang on and see it, even if it's not directly from his point of view, as that child might see it, either lower, physically lower, or sometimes featuring that which he is interested in more than that which he's not.
Well, it seems like that's really a part of the success of Belfast as well, is that it's so character driven. And by shifting the POV, you're really allowing the audience to become immersed in the family. And I'm curious if you would go through and do character specific passes in which you're focusing on the grandparents, you're focusing on the parents, just only them for one of the passes, to just find those fine tuned moments that just kind of slide into the movie seamlessly, even though they're sometimes away from Buddy's point of view.
Well, I did, as I was revising the screenplay. Yes, for sure. I would try and not be too neat, because I enjoyed the fact that it turned out not to be such a conventional structure, partly because of the way we used music and partly because we take a long time in a way to get to the nub of what the movie might be about for some people, if they need it to be about something, which I suppose essentially becomes this issue of whether or not they will leave a scene on a bus between mother and father, ma and pa, where she really lays out the sacrifice that they might make, this choice of whether you stay, you have identity, you have family, you have community, but you have constant danger, or you leave and you have safety and isolation. And in a way, prior to that, there are many, many slices of life. There are many, many slices of, working class communal sort of experience. But that sort of slight stream of consciousness, I was happy to do. And when I revised it, I found where I wanted to pepper it with grandparents' wisdom or observation, or even just the sort of snapshot of their relationship, as you say, apart from Buddy. And so, because I also wanted, in some ways, to, it seemed, however strongly I wanted to root myself in his point of view, there was also a practical thing going into the movie, thinking, I'm casting a 9, in this case, 10-year-old boy who has to carry the movie. I've got to give him some breaks. You know, I've got to somehow not, although we do it a lot, and we do it early on, not always play the big close-up with where the story of the film is written in his reactions. Sometimes other people have to do the heavy lifting. And if we can create enough of a sense that he is either literally or sort of metaphorically always earwigging what they're doing, and if we don't see him behind a banister on a staircase listening to what his parents are saying, he still may be outside that window where his grandparents, who are sort of watching the world go by but end up having quite a deep conversation, he could as easily be there and would as easily have been there in another kind of situation. So I did try and find the ways that structured things in order to let some of the storytelling pressure be, you know, released from him. But also, as you say, and I'm very thrilled to hear you say it, draw people into what is one of the moments of connection or empathy. Families discussing what decisions that are for them titanic in their implications for their right. own world, but may seem, you know, small beer outside, except we all know our lives are made up of these small/humongous decisions about whether you're going to move to the other side of the country or not and what it's going to be like, because it's probably going to be, and many people recognize this, life-changing.
Yeah. Well, I hope we chat again, because I have a lot more questions to ask, but I'll end on, obviously, what was your toughest scene and on the page, and how did you push through it? Next time we chat, I definitely want to talk about the riot scene, the violence in the beginning. It gave me kind of a flashback to your amazing work on Henry V. And, you know, I could just almost in my mind see you carrying the dead body of Christian Bale down that same chaotic street. But what was your toughest scene?
I would say, to be honest, Jeff, it was the one you mentioned. It was trying to find a scene where, from a practical point of view, we had everybody, the whole sort of crowd, 150 people who were masked in the time of COVID, but had to be choreographed with the violence. We chose to do a circular shot going 360 degrees, 2.5 times around young Jude Hill, a 10-year-old boy carrying the film. And every action, every member of the cast, every member of the crew, and the central star, as it were, our own Christian Bale de jour, was in the center of it, carrying it. You know, if he looked at the camera or just wasn't fully alive and present in the middle of that, that wouldn't have worked, and yet it was necessary for him to be at the center of the storm. That's what needed to happen. It's like it's his version of, you know, that tornado at the beginning of The Wizard of Oz. He's going to throw up his entire life, and it's going to land, and, you know, and in a way that he's going to have to negotiate and navigate for the rest of the film. So it was all the many moving parts in that, while also trying to lightly tell the story of Catholics versus Protestants, and introduce family members as well, and throw this, as it were, creative hand grenade into the beginning of a story that starts in modern Belfast in color and then goes into what I always had in my mind was, you know, another beautiful day in the neighborhood for just a couple of minutes before everything changes. So there was a lot of pressure on recreating the moment that, from my point of view, utterly and forever and profoundly changed my life. In those incidents changed the lives of so many people in Belfast. So it was a massive responsibility to try and get that right and make all those moving pieces work together.
You captured it excellently. I look forward to discussing it further. Congrats on a great film, and thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks. Good to talk to you again. I hope to talk to you again soon.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Special thanks again to writer-director Sir Kenneth Branagh for being so generous with his time and coming down and chatting with us today about his latest film, Belfast. And folks, while you're surfing around online, I hope you also check out Backstory Magazine over at backstory.net. You could read us on a desktop or laptop or via our iPad app, Backstory. You know, if you've never read us before, you could test drive us and read the entire free issue. And if you like what you see, I hope you consider becoming a subscriber. And if you want to subscribe, I am here to give you a discount coupon code of SAVE5. That's save and the number 5, and that will save you $5 off a 1-year subscription to Backstory Magazine. So look, it would really mean a lot to me to have my podcast listeners and iTunes and Spotify and my YouTube watchers of the Backstory Magazine YouTube page, which is where all these Zoom interviews go. So you could actually watch Kenneth Branagh talk so passionately about his movie on our YouTube page. It would mean a lot to me to have you support my passion project and become a subscriber. So thanks for considering. The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith podcast is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2022. All rights reserved. And folks, if you want to reach out to me and find me on social media, I'm Yo Goldsmith on Twitter or Backstory_Mag on Twitter. You could also find me on Instagram as Yo Goldsmith or Backstory_Mag. I have a Facebook fan page you could reach out to. You could also email me at backstoryletters@gmail.com. And that inbox gets a little busy sometimes, but I like to get through it when I can. So it just might take a beat. But I love hearing from everybody, and I'm always happy to respond. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory Magazine and the host of the Q&A podcast, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.